This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 333 was recorded on July 21st, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Convexity maven Harley Bassman returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss the relationships between inflation and bond yields, why the stock market has been so resilient in the face of worsening macro data, and much more. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick's chart deck will be titled, What's Next for the Summer? And to avoid a repeat of last week's 25-minute market wrap, I'm going to save most of my extensive crude oil market coverage for the post-game segment. There's a lot to cover in oil markets this week, so we'll wait for postgame when we have charts to reference for that discussion.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's get to that S&P 500. And, you know, bad news after bad news, the markets stopped selling off, and we just seemed to, I wouldn't call this a big rally, but it certainly stopped going down and is crawling higher. What do you make of it?
Well, I don't mind admitting that I am in a complete conundrum to understand this. It baffles me, and I freely admit that I am confused by this tape action. The best sign, as you just alluded, of when a bear market has ended is when you get more bad news that's clearly bad news, and the market doesn't go down on that bad news. And what we've seen in the last couple of weeks is plenty of more bad news. And in fact, we told you that last week, the Goldman Sachs flow trader echoed exactly the same sentiments in a note last Friday, where he said the number one question that Goldman Sachs has been getting from their clients is, what the heck is going on? How come this bad news, bad macro data, which is causing commodity markets to utterly tank, is not affecting the stock market? Well, he gave a bunch of good-sounding answers. Top of the list was, well, because we had options expiration last Friday, it tends to pin the market in one place. And, you know, watch out, after options expiration is over, might tank then. Well, guess what? After OPEX ended, it moved, but the other direction, going up. So by everything I know about signals that tell you when bear markets are over, it seems like, you know, this market bottomed in the middle of June and it's uphill from here. Frankly, I cannot bring myself to believe that, because everything that I see fundamentally tells me that the recession is going to be worse than most people think, is going to start sooner than most people think if it hasn't started already. And I think that there ought to be lots more down in this market. A lot of professional traders and big bank trading desks and so forth are publishing notes saying this can't be the end of the bear market. There's got to be more down. But look, we took out the 50-day moving average to the upside. I mean, for crying out loud, if the test is that when the bear market is over, you can get bad news and the market doesn't go down on it, we just got news this week that the president of the United States, who's 80 years old, got COVID and the market rallied on the news. I mean, what's going on here? I don't get it. So it's hard for me to believe that this bear market could be over. I don't think it should be over, but the tape action is saying it just doesn't want to go down on bad news. I don't know what to make of it.
All right. Well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar index, which has put together a pullback over the last week. But it'd be a far stretch to say it's a change in trend. And so what do you make of this pullback? Do you think there's more upside?
Well, I think you just said it, Patrick. We're finally seeing a correction after just a face-ripping rally higher. So it's finally correcting, but only in the context of a healthy bull market pullback. Ought to find support around 105 or so as I eyeball the chart. Unless we get a really big break lower than that, it seems to me like we're just in a pullback here, and there's plenty of reason to think the dollar moves higher from here.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil. We're looking at that September contract now. We traded up toward 100, pulled back a little bit. We're at $97 right now at the time of recording. What's your take here on crude?
Well, we had actually kind of a flash crash overnight in crude. I'm going to take a little bit of a different approach this week, because if I tried to cover crude the way I did last week, the market wrap would be even longer than last week's. So I'm going to give you highlights now and save the best of it for the postgame segment. Let's start with EIA inventory. Crude oil drawing down 446,000 barrels. Now, that was really a 5.4 million barrel drawdown if you include the 5 million barrels that was recklessly drained out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. But the headline number is 446,000. Cushing, Oklahoma, building a very desperately needed 1.1 million barrels. The big surprise on the board was a big build on gasoline, 3.5 million barrels. That is a sign that demand is weakening as people come to terms with the coming recession. Particularly discretionary consumer demand is more in the gasoline category, whereas commercial demand is for distillates, which still drew down 1.3 million barrels. U.S. production ticked down another 100,000 barrels, back down to 11.9 million barrels. The tape action in reaction to inventory was kind of meh, no real big action, until the Libya news just rocked the boat overnight, Wednesday into Thursday. Now, the impetus for that final move down to a 90 handle last week was when Libya lifted force majeure and announced that they were going to get their act together and start exporting crude oil again, because they had shut down their export terminals completely due to geopolitical tensions in that country. What was announced overnight last night was that they are back online producing. They've got 700,000 barrels now being produced, which is a little more than half of their target production of 1.2 million. barrels. They expect to be back to full production of 1.2 million barrels within 10 days or so. That news resulted in a $5 down spike overnight, now partially retraced in reaction to that news. We'll see how we do by the close. We're recording this market wrap before the pit close on Thursday, so we don't have the final numbers yet. I've got so much more to cover. I'm just going to give you the highlights of this. The August contract expired yesterday with $3.80 of backwardation right up until 2 hours prior to settlement. I want to really cover the significance of that and explain what it means. Several listeners set me straight on some errors that I made in my commentary last week about the mechanics of European gas and how it's delivered, and essentially explained to me why, if you wanted to wait until October to squeeze Europe, if you're Vladimir Putin, you really do have to shut the gas off sooner than that. We'll get to that in the postgame as well. And as part of that conversation, we'll also cover Gazprom first declaring force majeure, seemingly shutting off the gas to Europe forever. Then they waited a couple of days to see how the market would react, and they did actually resume operation of the Nord Stream 1 pipeline with reduced capacity today. We'll tell you all about that in postgame. Most people, though, missed a really significant statement from Saudi Arabia after President Biden's visit about their intentions to increase spare capacity, and more importantly, how little they can do to increase spare capacity. We'll cover that in postgame as well, and also talk about where all of this could be headed with respect to Vladimir Putin's intentions. Getting back to the present market, the slam down that we saw overnight was probably a combination of the Libya news, Nord Stream 1 coming back online, and the EIA gasoline build, all being bearish signals. As far as where the market goes from here, it's really hard to say in the very short term, because I don't think that the coming deep recession is fully priced in yet. That would suggest there's still plenty of room for more downside in oil prices as the market prices in the reality of what I think will be a very harsh recession. But the structural market tightness is nowhere close to priced in, so there's plenty of room for much, much more upside in coming months and years. But in terms of coming days and weeks, that's a harder call to make. That leaves me completely unsure of whether the next move is up or down. There's certainly scope if we get some more recession-related news to go down and test the contract 200-day moving average all the way down at 87 spot 69. To my thinking, that would be a logical bottom to this big move down that we've seen from $124? Do we get all the way there, or do we start coming to terms with the reality of just an incredibly tight physical market? We'll get into all of that and more in the postgame segment after the feature interview with Harley Bassman.
All right, Eric, let's get to gold. Earlier this morning, we saw a test of 1680, where all those 2021 lows were, and a bit of an intraday reversal. We're back to 1712, but gold's been under a lot of pressure. Do you think it's oversold enough to reverse, or is this just more of the same?
Patrick, I'm really not sure what to make of this. Gold has continued to disappoint at every turn, seemingly, but the scenario where I thought it was really going to get taken down was if the stock market really started to crash, and to my amazement, that's not happening, at least not yet. I think the news of President Biden's contracting COVID may have been a catalyst to get us off of that 1680, which, of course, was a very key support level to start with, so it makes sense to see at least a bounce there, but we're still well below all of the significant moving averages. You know, we really need to see a lot more upside before you could say this thing is over. And hey, we still don't know whether the stock market is eventually going to resume its bear market. The reason that I am still very much long gold and gold mining shares is I think that geopolitical risk is higher than perceived, and I think that if the situation between Russia and the West gets worse later this year, as I expect it probably will, that probably should help gold. Remember that Sergei Glazyev has proposed a BRICS digital currency, which is supposed to be backed by natural resources. So it's entirely possible that the reason China and Russia have been accumulating gold is because they intend to back a digital currency with gold. So I think long-term, there's plenty of reasons to care about gold, but boy, the tape action has been awfully disappointing.
Well, let's wrap up here with a 10-year yield, which tried to poke above 3%, but here we are back below 3% at the time of recording. It just seems like that upside gusto that yields had at the first half of the year, it really has really quieted down here. Do you think a top might be in on yields?
Well, of course, Harley Bassman, our feature interview guest, is a guru when it comes to fixed income. He's the guy who invented the MOVE Index, which is essentially the VIX for bond prices. So I want to defer mostly to Harley in terms of fixed income commentary. But as you say, Patrick, we're holding that 3%. We've had plenty of news, the CPI print last week and so forth, that you would have thought would be a catalyst for a move higher in yields, and it's not doing it. So very similar to the stock market commentary. When news that you think ought to push a market one way doesn't do it, it often means that that move in the market is over. And it could mean that the move higher in yields is over and we're about to see a reversal in trend. But I don't think we've seen enough of a move yet to say the trend is reversed. It's just time to watch carefully.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is Simplify Asset Management Managing Director Harley Bassman. Eric, why did we get Harley back this week?
Well, Harley is a fixed income guru, and as we just discussed, what the heck the 10-year is going to do next is a really important macro signal. And there's also a really important topic I want to discuss with Harley, which is we've talked before about how it's been so many years since we had structural inflation that nobody really knows how to trade it and what to make of it. A perfect example of that is the very definition of a recession. Now, of course, everybody knows the textbook definition of a recession is two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. But does it make sense to think about negative nominal GDP growth or negative real GDP growth adjusting for inflation? We're not used to thinking about that because for the last 40 years, inflation hasn't been a factor. So I want to ask Harley about that and a whole lot more. So I think you'll really find this interview interesting.
Well, Eric's interview with Harley Bassman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Harley Bassman, famously known as the Convexity Maven, and more recently, Managing Director for Simplify Asset Management. Harley prepared a terrific slide deck to accompany today's interview. I encourage you to download it, as we will be referring to the graphs and charts it contains throughout the interview. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button above Harley's picture that says, looking for the downloads. Harley, it's great to get you back on the show. I think the subject that's on everybody's mind is, okay, inflation, bond yields, WTF, over what is going on here? Because it seemed for a while like we really were seeing a breakout well above 3% on the 10-year yield. A lot of people were concerned, okay, this is the beginning of the end. The 35-year bond bull market is clearly over. We had a blow-off top, and it's all downhill in price, uphill in yield from here. But then we got this recent upside surprise on CPI inflation, which normally you'd expect that to spike Treasury yields much higher, and it didn't. So does that mean that the bottom's in on price and the top is in on yield and we're back to a bond bull market? And is inflation really transitory or not? How do we tie this all together? You pick whether you want to start with inflation or bond yields, and how do we make sense of those two things together?
Eric, thank you. Glad to be back on the show. You know, I've been in the non-transitory camp, the inflation camp, for a while. It's a simple U Chicago grad who believes in monetary policy, Milton Friedman, and you print a lot of money, you print money faster than the growth of the overall economy, you're going to get inflation. And thus we have this. You know, the transitory people, they will be right, okay? It's just a matter of when. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, I mean, life is transitory. So they're not wrong. They're just, you know, a bit early. I think you've hit on an interesting concept, which is mentioning inflation and interest rates in the same sentence. And I think what's different this time is maybe they're not linked as in the past for a variety of reasons. And I think that's why everyone's scratching their head. I think it's possible to say that we're going to have continued inflation that's maybe not a 9 print, but certainly 6 till the end of the year. That's pretty easy to go and say that. The question is, will rates move anywhere near that point? And the answer might be no for that, for a lot of stuff, not the least of which is the Fed probably is happy with a negative real rate. Negative real rates are great for the economy and great for the stock market. So the Fed might well keep that. And the uncertainty, of course, I'll join everyone else. It's the yield curve. That's what we can't figure out. You know, usually the yield curve inverts. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because all your guests talk about it. It usually inverts before the second to last Fed hike, right at the end. Here, it inverted basically before the first hike. And that's what we can't figure out. And the curve is right. We will have a recession. Are we in one right now? Unclear. But it's going to come. And so the market basically is trying to digest this cognitive dissonance of the curve versus your lying eyes of inflation.
Harley, help me understand the relationship between interest rates and inflation, because everybody says when inflation goes up, it makes interest rates go up. And I kind of think, well, wait a minute. In the past, when inflation goes up, it causes central banks to raise policy rates because they need to fight inflation. But we have a situation now where it's very difficult for them to raise policy rates very much because we've got so much national debt to contend with. So let's assume that central banks are not going to aggressively raise policy rates. Does inflation still cause long rates to go up just because there's inflation? Or does inflation only cause long rates to go up because central banks are fighting the inflation by raising policy rates?
Well, I mean, the rate you're talking about is the 10-year rates or their or mortgage rates, things like that, which is in theory linked to policy rates, but they're not really. The Fed controls the front end and they can do what they want to do. Back end is supply and demand. The idea that the two of them are linked, I guess, kind of makes sense. And the idea that why would you want to own a asset earning 3% when inflation is running at 6 or greater? You're losing, it's a negative yield when everything's said and done. And so logically, you'd think that that wouldn't make sense, but it can be different. I'd also say that I would push back very hard on the notion that the Fed can't go hard. I think they can. I think they will for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is Jerome Powell's legacy. If you really think about it, you know, what do we as human beings do? We still read the Greek tragedies. We read Shakespeare. Why is that? It's because these guys have zeroed in on the great human frailty of hubris, of ego. And that always drives people. That tends to be the great destroyer of mankind, is your ego harming you. What's Jerome Powell looking at right now? He's looking back at history and he sees Arthur Burns, who was the Fed chair in the 70s, who was bullied around by Nixon and other politicians, who did not raise rates, who let the inflation genie out of the bottle. And we had the huge inflation in the 70s, which was unpleasant. He's not thought of kindly now. We have Paul Volcker, who we could push back and forth about how much of the reduction of inflation was him versus demographics, versus other things going on. But nonetheless, he's well known as the guy that fought inflation, and he's thought of well now, although at the time he was not a hero. So Jerome Powell sitting here, and he's late to the party. We had inflation starting a year ago, and for reasons I would describe as political, which is they did not announce his renomination in August like they usually do. They did it in November. They didn't put him up for the vote quickly. They waited longer than that. And I think he was paralyzed from raising rates or reversing QE because he wanted to go and get the job. And he was concerned that if he took strong actions, the politicians would not reconfirm him. So I think he was hung up by politics for 9 months. I think he would have gone earlier. And now he's been, you know, released the Kraken. He's out there. He's talking about fighting inflation as a primary idea, more important than unemployment and the economy. And he's looking and saying, what do I want to be remembered as? What do I want my tombstone to say? Is it, you know, Jay Powell, you know, Arthur Burns Redux, inflation runs wild during his term, or, you know, Jerome Powell, the hero who slayed inflation? I can guarantee you it's the latter. And therefore, he's going to go and fight inflation however he can. The only tool he really has is interest rates, and that's what he's going to go and do. And so I think that the market is looking at the curve, looking at recession and all this stuff, but I think they underestimate what Powell's going to do to go and try to spear inflation. And I think rates can go a lot higher than what the market's pressing in or what people think.
Well, let's talk about how high rates can go, because if you read the doomsday bloggers, they would tell you, oh, look, you know, if the Fed tries to raise rates at the short end of the curve, it's going to bankrupt the U.S. government, because already we're spending almost 100% of tax receipts on interest payments. So if the interest payments double, you know, it kind of creates a problem, or you have massive more deficit spending and a need to really invoke modern monetary theory. How far can this go? How far can the Fed raise rates to fight inflation before you get to a situation where the federal government can't pay its bills?
Oh, the Fed, they can always pay their bills, man. God's sakes, they can print money. They've already been printing money for a decade. What's going to stop them?
Isn't that part of what's causing the inflation, though? I mean, haven't we gotten to a situation where if they print money in order to deal with this, that it's just going to make it worse?
He'll raise rates until something breaks. Something breaks being the economy. Well, I mean, inflation is a supply-demand disequilibrium. They can't push down supply or push up supply, so they'll push down demand. They will throw people in out of jobs. And think about it from the grand scheme of things. Look, if you break down the world into quintiles for the U.S., the bottom quintile is 0 to 27,000, roughly, income. Top quintile is 141 and above. Bottom guys, they'll get, you know, government support. Top guys, they don't care. So 60% in the middle. These guys actually care about inflation. It actually is going to significantly impact their lifestyle. That's a lot of people. If we take unemployment from 3.6 to 5.6 or 6.2, where it was for the last recession, okay, 2% of the people lose their jobs. That's pretty bad. Losing your job is worse than having inflation, but we're talking about 2% versus 60%. I think the Fed's going to go and balance things out and say, we'd rather go and reduce the damage to the entire 60% than for these small people who lose their jobs. And you know what? They're not wrong. So I think they could take this as high as they want. They will stop. I mean, they'll slow the economy down. We will go into recession. And we've already got, you know, the housing market's already going to go into the tank. You know, simple math, and I've you know, written about this before. When rates went down from 5 and change to 3 and change a few years ago, that basically accounts for 85% of why housing prices went up by 22. Now you're seeing the reverse. Taking rates from 3 and change to 5 and change, I've posted the math on my latest commentary. In theory, all else equal, housing prices would drop by 21%. Will they go down by that much? No, but that's a big number. And therefore, and you can see this on like chart 7 shows the monthly mortgage cost, holding everything else constant, takes the cost of running a mortgage up by 60-odd%. Remember, the average person does not buy a house. He signs up for a 30-year payment plan. And what he can afford is what he can afford. Okay, he's not some, you know, Wall Street gizmo is going to go and get a huge bonus. His income's going to move by 2, 3, 4% at best. And therefore, what he can pay is what he can pay. And therefore, you know, if rates go up, he'll buy less house or take on more debt, I suppose. But and housing is, I don't know, 15, 18% of the GDP. Okay, so you're going to go and slow down the housing market by a lot. It's not going to crash. We will not have a repeat of 08, 09. We have much tighter credit standards now, and people tend to pay their house before they pay anything else. You're just going to see a slowdown in the market, less turnover, lower prices, and that will slow down GDP.
Hartley, let's talk about what's causing the inflation, because some people would make the argument that, look, this has been brewing for 10 years. All of this easy money policy from the Fed had to eventually lead to inflation. Somehow they managed to avoid it. Then we really, really overstimulated into the pandemic. That was the straw that broke the camel's back, and that's what did it. Now, I could easily make the opposite argument that it had nothing to do with monetary policy and the fact that energy is an input to everything. And people who understand the energy markets understand that we've got a real supply-driven crisis that's only going to get worse, and that's driving the inflation. So what do you think is driving this?
A little of both. You know, I mean, the federal government mailed out checks to people, and they spent the money. They were locked up for 2 years, and now they want to travel. They want to do stuff, and you know, other things have wrinkled supply. I think the more interesting idea is how are the markets processing this concept right here, and the uncertainty of how it's going to play out. I think everyone knows we're going to have a recession, and everyone knows that we have a supply problem that's going to resolve in a year or two, one way or the other. It could be bumpy, but we know that. What's happening here is along the way, and this is what your readers, listeners care about, is how do you invest? How do you make money? What you've seen in the interest rate market is it's been vastly more volatile and uncertain than the stock market. So if you look at slide 2, the move, it got up to 155. It's now about 127. What drove that? The front end. We had no idea where to pin front end rates. Slide 3 is kind of interesting. It's the European move. That's going even crazier than the U.S. move because they've gone from negative rates to positive rates. But we're not going to go about that. But slide 4 is the more interesting one. And this one seems to be, you know, so popular on every website. It's the relative movement between the move and the VIX. The VIX is volatile for stocks. Move is volatile for bonds. And you can see how the move has gone vastly higher. Why is that? I'd say two things. Number one is that there is more uncertainty in bonds than stocks. But more important, let's remember this. Short-dated options, one-month options on liquid assets, stocks, bonds, commodities, oil, whatever it might be, is driven by realized vol. That is the number one prime driver. And what you tend to see is implied volatility trades 8 to 12% over realized. And when we had these very high vols of 155 on the move, it was realized in 140. what you're seeing right now is the move has come off to 127, and the 1 month realized is 120. On the VIX at 24, and the realized number is 21.5. It's just following the movement of the market. So there's no magic here per se about something's the wrong price. It's just that rates have moved relatively a lot more than stocks have. So it's not crazy.
Harley, I know you're a regular listener to the show, so you heard my comments last week, which were echoed by a Goldman Sachs flow trader who penned an article saying essentially the same thing, which is the most common question that he got from clients last week was, what the heck is going on with rapidly worsening macro data not causing the stock market to sell off? In fact, stocks are up strong as we're speaking on Tuesday morning, and really they got through last week where everything else was in big trouble. What's going on? And it's reflected here in your slide on page 4, where the VIX showing much, much lower equity volatility than bond volatility when bonds are supposed to be the more stable asset. Why is the stock market not crashing?
Well, I mean, this too is not rocket science. I mean, what's a stock? It's money you're going to get someday discounted back to today. And if you look at the big techs, the Amazons or the Netflix or the Facebook, we could stipulate they're going to make $1 trillion 30 years from now. So the only question really is, what's it worth today? When you get inflation in the early stages, that is very bullish for stocks. And the reason why is, by definition, if you have inflation, prices are going up. And if prices are going up, who's ever selling you the goods at higher prices is making more nominal dollars. Their nominal revenues are increasing. So that's good. On the other side, you have to discount that back. And so early on, when you get the inflation, that's good for stocks, good for earnings. But as rates go up, you have to discount them at a different rate. And that would then lower the PE, because the PE is nothing more than the discount rate, the cap rate for a cash flow. We have not seen rates go up. And therefore, stocks really should not be going down that hard. As I said before, negative real rates are good. The Fed would like that. If you could have inflation at, 5 and rates at 3, I mean, what's wrong with that? I mean, the Fed would like negative rates, because negative rates basically is positive for animal spirits. It basically means that someone starting a business or building a factory or whatever you want to call it can basically borrow money at negative rates. That's a good thing. So I think the Fed would like to go and pull that off. They just want to get inflation from 9 down to 4. We keep circling back to, why would the bond market allow a negative real rate? Why would the bond investors want to get a negative, net yield when all is said and done? I think the question for that comes down to is, why is that back end not going up? I'm going to guess what's happening here is, you have who buys 30-year bonds? I mean, you have hedge fund speculators, but let's get rid of them. You're talking pensions. And with the stock market having gone up by so much and bond rates having come down by so much, most of the defined pension plans are actually positive. Even the other pension plans are looking pretty good right now. They've been underwater for years. Now, I'm not talking the states. They're still screwed. But other pension plans are doing well. There's nothing wrong with taking your chips off the table once you finally won. Imagine you buy a stock, it goes down, it finally goes back up again. What are you thinking? I want out. I want to get in. So I think you're seeing long liability managers reducing risk in the stock market, and they're buying bonds to lock in their asset liability mix. Nothing wrong with that. And so, I think it's as simple as that. It's a supply-demand disequilibrium between the back end and the front end. Now, this is where I want to go diverge for 1 second and talk about, I'm talking about forward rates. I really appreciate that forward rates are not a prediction, okay? They are just the back end of a discount model. So in simple terms, let's think of this. And if you're, some big hedgy running $1 billion, you could turn your radio off for a second. If the one-year rate is 2% and the two-year rate is 3% and grandma has to decide what she wants to do, should she take the 2 or the 3, well, the idea is basically she's making a bet, is what is the one-year rate a year from now? If she thinks the one-year rate a year from now is going to be 2 before, That means she gets 2% for the first year, 4% for the second year, 3% for the entire two-year horizon, you know, ignoring some of the details of compounding. That's it. Nothing more, nothing less. So when you get a spot yield curve that goes 2 to 3, the forward is 4. Nothing more, nothing less. It's not a prediction per se. It's just a break-even number. And so when we start looking at Eurodollars or other, you know, instruments out there, and a Eurodollar is nothing more than a 3-month forward, and it's strictly, you know, the back end of the spot yield curve. Is it predicting the Fed to cut rates? Not really. Is it predicting a recession? Not really. But they are interesting numbers when you get these curves to go up and go down. So the more interesting question is not that the front end's peaking in December or March. It's why is the back end hooking on down? I guess it could be people thinking we're going to recession, but I think it's more than that. I think there's a need for long duration assets from people who are asset liability managers, and it creates this illusion that, you know, of fear, but maybe it's not as complicated as that.
Harley, we're taught that the asset that's supposed to benefit the most from negative real yields is gold, but gold's just barely managing to hold 1700 here, down a few hundred bucks from its high, and this is at a time. You know, the other thing that affects gold is geopolitical tension. We've got a conflict between nuclear superpowers and, you know, big threats on the table. What's going on there?
Gold is an alternate currency. Nothing more, nothing less. And should you own gold? The answer is yes, it's a diversifier. It's a non-liability asset that you can pick up in your hand. So owning that is pure diversification. I think gold works over a very long horizon, like 20, 30 years. The old expression was an ounce of gold could buy a fine man's suit or a fine man's armor, or a fine man's toga. I think that's still the case today. So yes, it's good to wrap a story around it, but it's a very long lead time instrument. And I think to try and trade it as a short-term idea is foolishness. That's it. It's like the euro or the yen or something else. It's just a currency.
So you don't see it as an effective speculation. A lot of people say you want to hold gold because look at what's going on with central banks debasing the currency. Surely it has to mean gold explodes to the upside. You know, the doomsday bloggers say it's $5,000 an ounce by next year. Of course, I don't believe that's going to happen. But the underlying thesis, is that flawed or what's going on?
I think they're right. They're just early. I mean, will gold be at $5,000 someday? Yeah, of course it will. I don't think it's going to be tomorrow. I think what's going to drive gold, more importantly, is going to be the ultimate denouement of how we process the baby boom generation. I mean, that is by far the number one problem we have in the world right now. If you look at Social Security, 1936, the equivalent of age 62 back then is like 84 right now. Could you imagine retiring at age 84? I mean, you know, and we've made promises that, can we keep them? Unclear. I'm much more worried about processing the baby boom generation, which is barely halfway into retirement. That's a much bigger deal than caring about whether the funds rate's at 4% or 5%, because that number can move around pretty quickly. And I think it's a public policy challenge to how we're going to do it, because the boomers still vote. They still control the purse strings. The millennials don't vote, which is foolishness. And so dealing with that, that's also an interesting concept, is people talk about how income, the demand side of the equation is going to slow down for various reasons. Then they point to the economy or jobs, this or that. I want to look at page 18, which I kind of like a lot, which is the boomers have amassed a massive amount of wealth via housing, stocks, bonds, other various assets, and they're going to pass them along. And if they're passing along X trillion per year, I don't want to say predicted, but they're going to die and they're going to give it to their kids, I presume, that money's going to get spent. And this occurs to me as I think about, as I sit here in New York City right now, you know, how do millennials, I have four kids, how do they buy an apartment in New York City? How do their kids go to private school? High-class problems for sure, but nonetheless, the apartments are still full and the schools are still full. I'm guessing that grandpa and grandma are funding this, and that's just a way of transferring wealth. So maybe the millennials don't need to have incomes that are exploding like the boomers did. Maybe the transfer of wealth over the next 10, 15 years will be enough to keep the demand side of the equation higher than we expect.
Harley, while you're on the topic of mortgages and housing and so forth, I noticed back on page 6, you've got an MBS chart here. Is there a trade? How do we think about these things in terms of translating them into trading opportunities?
Am I comfortable saying buy bonds here? Not really. I guess I'm more bearish than bullish on bonds because I think that rates are going to go up. But within the sector of the bond market, I think the mortgage-backed security, you know, Fannie, Freddie, Ginnie bonds, are the cheapest thing on the planet. There's no credit risk. So if we get the recession, I'm not going to have a problem with high yield or even, you know, investment grade getting down, pushed on down. You know, a mortgage security is nothing more than an amortizing bond with a call feature to it. It's a covered call. That's it. And right now, you're seeing the spread, and that's what's on page 6, between 10-year rates and mortgage rates at about 130. That is crazy wide. We've only seen this a few times in the past, and usually during panic scenarios. They just don't stay here. And why it's here is we've had a lot of volatility and also a lot of fear. Fear that, you know, mortgages are going to go and, you know, widen out. Their duration will lengthen. That's already happened. If you look at slide 8, most mortgage bonds have already gone down a lot in trading, you know, high 80s, low 90s. They've already extended. To be able to go and get a effectively AAA credit at 130 over strikes me as being, you know, a rather fancy number. I think people are worried. They're kind of front running maybe the Fed, who's going to stop buying mortgages and effectively sell them. The Fed would prefer to go and sell mortgages before treasuries. They'd like to get rid of those off their balance sheet first. So yes, there's a good reason to be concerned. But the mortgage pipeline, the supply of mortgages, it's going to come to a grinding halt. There will be no refinances. All you're going to have is new issue mortgages coming out. And that's going to slow down, as I noted before, because, you know, rates are higher. So the supply of mortgages is really going to crunch down. It takes like 3 months for this to happen because the mortgage pipeline, you know, between the time the guy signs a contract to when they close the mortgage is easily 3 months. And you're, so here's your window right now. So if you have assets in investment grade or treasury securities, I'd be moving them into the mortgage market right now. And if, with the move coming down from 150s to 120s, if things kind of stabilize, as a value, it's the best thing I see on the planet. I also am interested in some of the, I guess, the mortgage REITs. At a 130 spread, and by the way, this thing was trading at a 40 spread last year. A 130 spread levered up 7-1. That's looking pretty interesting. The only real risk for this kind of trade is how high the Fed takes the front end up, because they have to borrow money for the leverage at that rate. So that's, but in theory, bigger mortgage REITs know what they're doing and they hedge out that financing risk. So as investments go, I kind of feel comfy with putting money there.
Harley, the slide you've got on page 12 really jumps off the page. Just look at that gigantic spike on the green line there, which is the GDP index, and look at the red line that has historically followed it. Which way does it go? Because we saw a spike down and a spike up. What comes next?
Well, this is the interesting topic over here. Is technically a recession is back-to-back quarters of negative real GDP. We had negative in the first quarter, and looking at the Atlanta GDP now, we're going to get another one in a few weeks. So that back-to-back, so we're in a recession technically. Is that really the case? I kind of don't think so, because what we have here is nominal GDP is running very high, you know, 6%. We have inflation of 8, and therefore we have a real of negative 2 or thereabouts. But is that really a recession when you have nominal GDP growing at 6? I kind of don't think so. And so this idea of saying that we're in a recession right now, I don't know. The economy is growing a lot nominally, which is good. But there is an MBA finance concept that nominal GDP and nominal 10-year rates should be kind of linked. The idea being that nominal GDP is what the factory makes for a profit, and the 10-year rates would cost to go borrow to fund it. And therefore, they should be linked together. And we've had that linkage more or less up and down forever. I don't see how we could have nominal GDP up at you know, 8, and rates at 3. Something's wrong there. And maybe the answer is we're going to get the recession and drag nominal down. That requires inflation to come down also. I don't buy that. I kind of think this is kind of like, you know, a lot of things that I'll propose. When you see a wide gap, you know it's got to come in, but it's unclear which way. I'm still a believer that we're going to see, I think, longer rates rise. We're not going to get crazy long rates, but they're going to rise. I don't see inflation going away anytime soon. And so therefore, nominals should stay pretty high. But I think that the bigger idea is looking more on a macro basis is, you know, what's driving all of these things. And I tend to think that notwithstanding supply demand, it's demographics. You know, slide 17 suggests the idea that what drove the inflation of the 70s was the baby boomers pig in the python. Baby boomers, they were born, they come in, they get to be age 25, 30, and they get married, they buy a house, they buy a car, they buy a washing machine, and they're buying all these goods as they form households from the prior generation, the World War II generation, which was smaller for a few obvious reasons, a war, but also it was just depression babies, so fewer of them. We're seeing now a bit of growth in the millennials. It's actually a bigger group than the boomers. It's just smaller by percent. And I also think that what you're seeing right now is these millennials, they get married later. I mean, my kids just got married last year, which is 4, 5, 6 years later than they used to do. And I think these boomers, these millennials are going to be buying assets, buying goods. They're buying them from boomers who are retiring. And I think the magical missing 5 million people, I don't think they're missing. I think they made a lot of money in the stock market and they just quit. So you have a mismatch here as households are formed by millennials, boomers are retiring, and that's going to go and that's going to keep inflation, you know, supported on the demand side. On the supply side, I think slide 16 is actually the scariest thing that I see. You know, 5 years ago, when after the first election, you know, I opined that I was not worried about taxes or about regulation or other things like that. My concern of the unintended consequence of bad things happening was immigration. The reason why the U.S. has outperformed Europe and Japan and everywhere else is net, 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 we have had a positive labor force growth rate. That's it. And if you think about it, GDP at the end of the day, number of people, how many hours worked, how productive they are. We've had that growing. By slamming the door on immigration, which in slide 16 is what you see, this is going to be very problematic. Our birth rate, number of kids per childbearing woman, has been declining. We've been making it up in the past by immigration. To the extent we just keep this door closed, that's going to be the biggest problem we face. I think if we have net immigration, positive immigration to make up for everything else, we'll probably be okay. But if we keep seeing this over here, things don't end well then. Then we start to look like Europe as opposed to the U.S.
Now, this is a Census Bureau chart. So should we assume that this accurately reflects the legal immigration or the illegal and legal immigration aggregated?
Oh, I suspect it includes illegal. And this whole idea of illegal immigration, I mean, I'm not going to dig into the politics, but the reality is, however they get over here, I don't care. They come here, they work, they pay taxes. Maybe not income taxes, but when they rent a house to stay in, that landlord pays taxes. When they go to a store to buy goods, they pay sales tax. So they're engaged in the economy. I'm not going to dig into, you know, their medical care or education. You can go fight that battle somewhere else. The reality is they are contributing to the economy when they come here, legal or otherwise. And we know for a fact that's been reduced as what they do. Yeah, we have at the border issues right now, but at a macro level, we've been reducing immigration for 5 years now.
And is that a result of the clampdown during the Trump administration on illegal immigration, or is it also a reduction of the number of visas authorized for legal immigrants?
All the above. I mean, why we're not offering more, the various visas for people is kind of beyond me. There are certain people who have skills to go be productive in science. There's people who can be productive in terms of agriculture. And really, I mean, I'm not sure where you live, but everything I see is help wanted everywhere. Look at what they said. Heathrow Airport is limiting the number of passengers that can come through to 100,000 per day. They're at 104 right now. So they're requesting the airlines go and move people around to reduce people. And they do that because they don't have enough baggage carriers or pilots or everyone else. I think it's across the economy that this, you know, disruption of the economy because of the lockdowns. Was that good public policy or bad? We could debate that, but we know what the result is right now, is that we eliminated a lot of people who aren't going to come back. And that's going to, once again, I think add to supply problems where they're not going to be at work. And the only way to get people to come back, you got to pay them more. So that is just going to keep on going. Is it this idea of having this runaway, you know, Venezuela inflation? We don't need that. All we have to do is have inflation coming in at 4 or 5%, which is, I think, pretty easy to do, to go and kind of, you know, make it a quandary as to what do rates do in the long run and what does the Fed do? And I think the Fed's going to go look at a 5 number and say, I don't like that. And they're going to take rates up to go and deal with it. I mean, if you go look at slide 10, you know, CPI versus the Fed funds rate. Is it different this time? I suppose so. No, disagree. It's not. It's never different this time. And I think the Fed's going to go look at things like this and say, we got to get rates up enough to go and just pull the kettle off the boil.
Let's go back to what you said earlier about demographics, and the millennial generation is as big as the baby boomers in terms of the number of people involved. But the thing is, they're nowhere close in terms of assets. And I do see your point that some of those baby boomers are going to give their kids, you know, the inheritances that will include both money and homes. But still, millennials don't have a lot of savings. So I guess what I'm not seeing is if the millennial generation is the new baby boomers, you know, the echo boom or whatever you want to call it, they're not very well capitalized. So how do we continue to see the asset price levels, particularly in housing, that we're used to? As you said earlier, you know, the place that housing numbers come from is either you've already got an expensive house and you trade up to another one and, you know, you sold the first one and that gives you a bunch of money. And then it's based on what you can afford from your income. As we see, now we got all the way to almost zero interest rates. We're coming off of that now. So the amount of money people can borrow based on their income is going down. I don't see a big trend in baby boomers being super generous and giving all of their assets over to their kids. A lot of them are spending it and not giving really large inheritances. So where does this baby boomer generation get rich? And if they don't get rich, how do they continue to support asset prices that we're used to, particularly in real estate?
I mean, get rich is a different concept than cover the payments. All they need is income to cover the payments. So are we going to have assets increasing in value? Probably not. But can they afford a house? Yeah, probably. And you're probably going to see a continuation of people migrating out of the blue states to the red states. And that's not political, but I mean, you know, selling California or New York or Connecticut and moving to, you know, Texas or Florida, especially now that you can do this because it's, Zoom exists. It didn't exist before. The company I work for, Simplify Asset Management, this company doesn't exist before COVID, right? I mean, we have people in San Fran and in Vegas and Newport Beach and LA and Virginia and Boston and New York. Like, how do you go and have a company built like that before Zoom? And so if all of a sudden people are able to go and work from home, all of a sudden they become very mobile and they're not stuck in the expensive states. Now, does that mean that California and New York City go down in price? No, maybe, but I think they can certainly afford, if you're getting paid a reasonable salary, you can afford some kind of dwelling in a less expensive area. I do think that what you're really hitting on here is the public policy concept that the boomers have basically stolen from the millennials. And I agree with that. I think that's a great wrong. How to fix that? It's unclear. We've made promises that we hope to keep, but I suspect we're going to go and do some kind of income targeting for Social Security and other things. The government can't pay for everyone to go and retire like princes. So there'll be limits put on that. But yeah, I think the biggest public policy struggle right now is processing the boomer generation as they get older and they retire.
Harley, final question. I want to make sure we cover slide 15, where you've got the correlation between the S&P 500 and the 10-year Treasury yield. Tell me about this chart.
Well, they're all linked, actually. 14 and 15 are linked together. And this is a concept I've been, you know, hammering on for a while now. There's been a very strong correlation between stocks and bonds the last 20 years where they hedge each other. Stocks up, bonds down, and vice versa. That really was the underpinning of the 60-40 portfolio. That seems to be, looking at chart 14, a correlation that is linked to rate level or inflation level. Those two were the same thing before. They're not the same thing now, as we spoke about earlier. My great worry is this. If we get rates or inflation up high enough, you're going to start to see that stock-to-bond correlation flip over and go back to what it was 30 years prior, which is stocks and bonds go up and down together. We're not there yet. I think you got to go and get rates up to about 4% to go and do that, because that's a level where you start to go change the PE of a stock, where the rate, the discount rate impacts it. We're not there yet, but you can see already that we've really kind of turned down slide 15 to having no correlation or negative correlation in some places. This will be, if this occurs, this is the Achilles heel for the market. We've had it twice before where the stock bond correlation has flipped over, where they go up and down together. This is November, December of 18, March of 2020. Both times the Fed stepped in to go and save the day. If we get stocks and bonds down together, that means everything goes down together. Anyone who's levered all of a sudden gets margin called, or at least gets very sad. And I think that's why you got to be concerned about longer term rates. That's why, and that's why, you know, we have created various hedge products at my firm for interest rates. Not because we believe that rates are going to 4, but if they do, it'll be really, really problematic. And I think that people should be looking at ways to go and be covered if those back end rates start to go higher, because that's going to kick the stock market down hard. We're not there yet. And if the Fed can manage to go and soft land us, then I guess it'll be okay. But I think the correlation flipping is the greatest risk to financial assets.
Well, Harley, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. First time we interviewed you, you are technically in retirement, but you've actually gone back to work with Simplify Asset Management. Tell us about what took you back, where the opportunity is that brought you back into the industry, and how people can find out more about what you do there at Simplify.
Well, you know, I call myself the convexity maven because I like to focus on risk assets that have convexity optionality put into them. What we do at Simplify, which is totally unique, is that we create ETFs that have long optionality, long convexity, long option-like features. So your gains are accelerated, your losses are cushioned. We do this in a way that is relatively clever, and so it doesn't cost that much. And a few things, I mean, some of the products are geared to making money if things happen. Others are geared to cushioning your loss. So if you think about March 2020, the real risk in March 2020 was not the prices went down, because they all came back. The risk was you sold and got stopped out and didn't get back in. If you buy a product that has a cushion to it, it'll stop you from getting out when it's scary. And I'll tell you, even for myself, when we're at the bottom, I'm under my desk crying. When we're at the top, I'm in euphoria also. We are social animals. We all feed back with each other. And so having products that will self-insure themselves is a pretty clever idea. We've gone from zero to $1.4 billion in short order, and it's a very exciting thing for me. We were able to do this because of changes in regulation, and we have some great guys on the team. One of them is Mike Green, is always on your show as a guest, and we're both like loving this new venture over here.
Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this. After being completely sold out of advertising space for the last couple of years, we finally have capacity to add a new advertiser. Macro Voices has a Podtrac certified global audience of over 170,000 listeners, and each weekly episode typically gets 60,000 to 80,000 downloads. We have more than 20,000 accredited investors who have registered with us as accredited, and we estimate the total accredited investor audience as at least 40,000 accredited listeners, which we believe to be the highest number of accredited investor listeners of any podcast on the internet. We strive to accept tasteful advertising from advertisers whose product is likely to appeal to our audience. So we're looking for another investment or financial services advertiser to fill the space I'm speaking in right now. Mail order Viagra salesmen need not apply. If your company wants to advertise on Macro Voices, please email sponsorship@macrovoices.com for more information. Now let's get right back to the show.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Harley back on the show. His insights always are great. I find that, you know, looking at things from a probability perspective is so important in the markets, and he's just so good at that. And I really loved his insights. What did you take away?
I think that the discussion about real versus nominal GDP growth and the definition of recession is particularly important. Now, I agree with Harley. I think that what matters in terms of, you know, theoretical economics is when the economy stops growing and starts contracting, that's what a recession is. And in order to meaningfully measure that, you ought to do it on an inflation-adjusted basis. That only makes logical sense. But you won't find that in any textbook that I've ever read. It just says, you know, negative GDP growth, 2 quarters. That's the Niebuhr definition. And I think most people in the market are going to continue to interpret that as negative nominal growth. And that kind of insulates you from recession. It means that you can have a real GDP growth recession that doesn't technically qualify as a negative GDP growth on a nominal basis recession. And people then have a disagreement about whether we're even in a recession. It just adds confusion to the system, and that, I think, leads to more volatility. In any event, let's move on, speaking of volatility, to a very interesting subject for this week's post-game chart deck. What's next for the summer? And of course, we'll also include my extended crude oil coverage. Listeners, you'll find the download link for the chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button above Harley's picture that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, what's next for the summer?
Well, I wanted to hit the S&P 500 first. And what we clearly have is now a breakout of the trend line and closing prices above the 50-day moving average, which are some of the first signs of that the bulls are at least mustering up something from an incredibly oversold condition. But I wanted to just put the S&P into a little bit of context. I mean, we've been selling for 6 months straight. I mean, yeah, there was a bit of a rally in March, but overall, it's been a pretty predominant downtrend that has been ongoing for 6 months. And inevitably, like if you look back at previous bear markets, even let's say using the analog of 2008, while the whole bear market was 18 months, there were multiple bear market rallies that occurred during that period. So after 6 months of selling, seeing a counter trend rally is not out of character. So now that these trend lines are broken, what I'll be watching to see is if we can get the S&P closing north of 4,000. At that moment, that may usher in a short-term summer rally that during the month of August could see 41, 4,200 on the upside and a quiet grind that makes the next kind of sell window going into the September and into the fourth quarter. And so really, if at this moment the S&P follows through here and we start closing about 4,000, it may just mean that the summer is just going to be a quiet grind and the real moves are coming later this year.
Well, that certainly makes sense, and I think it's consistent with some other major bear markets that we've seen. I don't have the chart in front of me, but just off the top of my head, and forgive me if I get this wrong, folks, because it's more than a decade that I'm going on my memory now. I think the 2008 event, we had a pretty good summer rally that tricked a lot of people into thinking, okay, the bottom's in. And then the really ugly move didn't come until, you know, September, October, when it really got nasty and we got new lows and then the bottom fell out of the market. So I guess the question is, it looks like you're targeting around 4,000. I'm assuming that you chose that number because it would be equivalent to the late May peak, the last significant peak that we saw that tested that trend line. Is that what you watch for? And, you know, well, if we go above that, does it change the outlook to say this really was the bottom? Or how do you think you would know when the next move down has begun? Because it seems like we just broke a trend line. There ought to be a bit more upside before this rally is over, at least in terms of reading the technicals, even though that's completely at odds with what I think is going on fundamentally.
The significance of 4,000, it was just it's a round number. Really, it was about that descending trend line with the Fibonacci retracement and the moving averages all kind of converging in that 3950 to 4,000 zone. And so really the way I look at it is that once the market has cleared that zone, it has beat all of those resistance levels and is signifying that that their bulls have a little bit more gas in the tank than just a quick little retrace. trace that rolls right over. And so that's the only significance of that. And I like just to reference round numbers that way. But anyway, let's move on to the Euro chart, because we had the ECB do a rate hike and announce the QE for Italy. And yet the Euro never really moved in any meaningful way. It started in the green right off the bat, going toward this 103 level. I was thinking there was room for the euro to even make it back towards 104 as a retracement. But so far, it's been a very muted weak rally. And just like we were talking about the dollar index in the market wrap, there is no evidence that the prevailing downtrend has ended. This is simply a very oversold condition. We printed parity. It got all over the headlines. It was a very oversold number. And we're just seeing a little bit of a relief rally or almost a bounce. But I just don't see anything that is telling me that the prevailing downtrend has changed. And we're going to need more evidence than that. But I would still be watching if the euro starts to roll over as a signal.
Let's move on to gold futures on page 4. Chart does not look healthy at all. We just hit 1680, which, of course, Ole Hansen told us more than a year ago. I think that was a really key level. It held a year ago. You think it's going to hold this time?
Well, yeah, the key thing here is that what I was surprised by was the fact that a lot of cross currencies were bouncing. The US dollar was pulling back and you couldn't even get a pulse out of gold. It was just showing that at least at this moment, there was no immediate correlation response. We got very oversold, traded right down into the 1680. At least this morning, we've got a reversal candle that we haven't seen the close yet, but maybe it is like a little bullish engulfing candle, but it's a stretch to call this a reversal already. It's still a very distinct downtrend and no meaningful bull breakout. At some point, I actually think gold can very easily bounce back to 1750, but that wouldn't make it an uptrend. That would just be an incredibly oversold market that's bouncing like we're seeing in so many other assets today. So right now, I would respect a downtrend, but a bounce I think is imminent, but that doesn't make me bullish gold yet for the next big uptrend. I think it might take the rest of the summer to really establish the basing formations that gold would need in order to have a fourth quarter rally. And that's going to take, like I said, much of the summer to work out. So I think it's a wait and see in this market. But with that said, Eric, I wanted to move on to crude. Obviously, you have some insights on what's going on. I just wanted to technically observe one thing here and then let you give some insights. The one thing that I was watching for as we approached 100 was that when we inevitably get some sort of news that causes oil to have a quick sell-off, will it show the same characteristics as the S&P 500, which is it starts brushing off bad news and then recovers? So over the next couple of trading sessions, what I'd be really interested to see if whether crude generally holds above 93 to 95 and then starts working its way back to 100. And every time there's bad news, it just brushes it off and doesn't make lower lows. If we start seeing that, that could actually start to signal that the one plus month correction in crude oil may have already run its course, but it's still a little early. But that's certainly what's on my mind. What are you thinking?
Patrick, there's a huge amount of merit to what you just said, and I think we're starting to see the signs of it, but not completely. And the Libya news, I think, is a really good indication of that. If we look at that very low point that we had last week, it was the news of Libya lifting force majeure. They had previously announced through a force majeure notice that they were going to stop exports completely due to geopolitical tension in Libya. It was the removal of that force majeure which caused the spike down that ended up going right back up the same day and creating that reversal candle that we see a week ago. Then we had more news out of Libya, similar news. This time it was just, hey, they're on track. They've gotten halfway or more than halfway back to full production. They expect within 10 days to be back at full production. We saw a $5 overnight spike last night, way on down to a 94 handle. I think 94.59 was the low print overnight. We're back up now, as I'm speaking, above $97, and that's about halfway back to where we started before the news came out. Now, some levels to watch there. If we could get above the all of the short-term moving averages, that would be the five-day as the top at 98 spot 33. If we could close above that today, that's more than another dollar, and we've only got about a half an hour left in the session, so I strongly doubt we're going to make that. That would say, okay, the market is completely brushing off bad news and just grinding along, as you alluded. So I don't think we're quite there yet, but we're maybe halfway shrugging off bad news. So I think we're getting closer to that outcome that you're describing.
Eric, what you're saying makes complete sense, but let's move on to page six, because you asked me to put the term structure up, and I'd love to hear what is on your mind.
Well, we had several listener requests for a refresher on why backwardation is a bullish signal in the crude oil market or commodity markets generally. What we see on page six, it's not a time series. These are three different snapshots of specific dates. So the bottom term structure, the one you see at the bottom of the chart that slopes upward, that is from November of 2020, so about 18 months ago. And what that shows is the usual shape of any commodity. The normal condition for most commodities is the cheapest price is if you want to buy right now. If you want to lock in a price right now today for delivery in the future, normally the market would say, well, okay, look, if you want us to do that, the only fair way to do it is to start with today's price and then consider what's the cost of storage, what's the cost of insurance, what's the cost of, you know, the interest rates and everything. If you want to lock in a price from a year from now, it's going to cost you more because you're getting the benefit of being able to lock that price in at today's prices or a price determined from today's price, and you're not going to take delivery for a year. We got to charge you something for that. That's called contango. That's the normal condition of commodity markets. When you get into a shortage situation, what happens is the sellers of the commodity are scratching their head saying, we don't know where we're going to get enough of that commodity, enough oil in this case, just to meet the commitments we've already made this month. So we'll give you a discount if you're willing to wait and accept delivery of the oil that you buy today a year from now. We'll give you a cheaper price. That's called backwardation, and it's an indication that the physical market is tight. It means that there's not enough oil in the storage tanks for the normal contango condition to exist, and the sellers of oil are charging a premium for oil that is sold in the future. Now, if we look at the next term structure, the middle one on the chart here, that's from 1 year ago today. Now, remember what was going on last July. Crude oil prices got all the way up to $75. Oh my gosh, everybody thought, well, that's not sustainable. Surely it's going to sell off back down to 50 or so. I mean, it can't be sustained. The thing is, the physical market was tightening up. People were getting very concerned about Cushing, Oklahoma running out of oil completely. And that's why we got to what was at the time being discussed. I'm talking not about the brightest yellow, but the middle one. The one that is from 2021, July 21st, 1 year ago today. At the time, analysts were saying that backwardation, in other words, the downslope that you see where the front month contract at the left edge, that's the immediate delivery. If you're willing to lock in a price today for later delivery, you get a discount. Well, the discounts were so steep a year ago that most analysts were saying, this is crazy steep backwardation. It's not sustainable. There's no way it could possibly last. It has to be an anomaly associated with the ending of the COVID pandemic. It's temporary. We're going to go back down to that normal looking term structure that you see at the bottom of this chart, the one from November of 2020. Surely we've got to get back to that because it's so steep, this backwardation, it just has to be an anomaly. Well, fast forward to today, that's the brightest yellow, the top term structure in the chart, and you can see whether that was considered at the time to be an anomaly back last year. It's a much bigger anomaly right now. In fact, it is record-setting backwardation. And what we're talking about by when we say backwardation is the vertical space between those dots on the chart. Each dot represents one delivery month. So you go three dots down the chart, that's buying oil if I want to lock the price in today for delivery 3 months from today. What it's showing us is there is a very, very steep discount. In fact, it's several $1 per month. Now, to give you historical perspective on this, if we analyze all of the data back to the beginning of the crude oil market, at least as far as the data goes back to the early 1980s, it is unusual for there to be more than 50 cents per month, half a dollar per month of backwardation is unusual. It's normally associated with some kind of tension. There's a war, there's something going on. More than a dollar per month is kind of unheard of. It usually means that, you know, the Canadian wildfires in, I think it was 2018, led to just a few months at the very front end of the curve blowing out to $2 or $3, but it was only at the very, very front of the curve, and it corrected very quickly as the fires came under control. There have been incidents where there was a spill on the Keystone Pipeline that jeopardized supply of oil into Cushing, and just that front spread would blow out to $2 or $3, and it would stay there for a few days. But it's very, very unusual to get all the way to the expiration of one of these contracts. But it's extremely unusual for one of these contracts to reach expiration, in other words, to get to its last trade date, which we just had yesterday on the August delivery contract. Now, it expires in July because it's for delivery of oil to occur in August. So we call it the August contract, but it's really the one that expires in the end of July. It expired yesterday, and right up until 2 hours before the close, it was trading at $3.80 of backwardation, which I believe to be an all-time record in the history of the oil market. In context. What do I mean by in context? There certainly have been things like the start of the Gulf War in 91, where there were just crazy, crazy blowouts in backwardation at the front of the curve. But as far as the expiring contract on its last trade day having more than $3 of backwardation, absent a catalyzing event, meaning there's no Canadian wildfires, there's no Keystone Pipeline spill, there's no bombings on the Abqaiq facility in Saudi Arabia, which caused a massive blowout in time spreads. There's no event to explain this. It's just because the market is really, really tight. I don't think we have ever in the history of the oil market seen this happen. I don't have intraday data going back more than a few years. If any listeners have that, I would absolutely love to know whether there are prior examples of an expiring contract on its last trade day at noon, that's 2.5 hours before the close, being more than $3 of backwardation premium above the next contract. I don't think it's ever happened before, other than at a time when there was a bombing or a war or a Keystone Pipeline spill or something like that. Why do I say at noon? Well, for the last hour or so, the insiders are always gaming this market because the open interest drops to a level where it's very easy for them to do that. So we saw it trading through most of the session yesterday on its final trading day at about $3.80. It did collapse to $2.66 of backwardation. That's still massive backwardation as of the close, and that's due to market manipulation by the insiders. The real number it was trading at is, you know, a couple hours before the close when there's still efficient price discovery in the market. So I'm going to say as of noon, I don't think there's ever been a $3.80 close absent some major war breakout or other event going on. If anybody has that data, please let us know. I'd love to know that answer. So I think it's very significant. What does it say? We've got an incredibly tight physical market. Now, it's tempting to say, well, okay, is that tight physical market just an anomaly because of COVID ending? And, you know, we've got the tension with the Ukraine war, which a lot of people think is ending now. I don't think it's ending, but a lot of people think it's ending. Maybe it's just going to last for the rest of the summer and then it's all going to get better. Well, the way you can tell is to look at this term structure chart, and you do see it's incredibly steep backwardation for about the first 6 months or so. And there's kind of an inflection point in the curve, and it does mellow out a bit, but hang on. Remember that middle term structure, the one from a year ago, that was considered unbelievably steep backwardation at the time. And what we see is the entire curve going out in today's curve, the brightest one at the top of the chart, it goes out for the next couple of years at a much steeper backwardation than we saw at the very front of the curve a year ago, which most people thought was unsustainable. So what the term structure chart is telling us is that the physical market is incredibly tight. It's expected to remain super duper tight, at least for the next 6 to 8 months. Then maybe it gets a little better, but not much better. So this chart is just screaming out that the physical market is incredibly tight and expected to stay tight. And that is massively, massively bullish for oil prices. Well, if it's so bullish, then why the heck, if we go back to page 5, do we see oil selling off ever since that $124 peak back in the middle of June? And on this chart, it shows about $117. The reason is this is the September 22 contract. Back in June, the July contract was the front month. And because that backwardation is so steep, the chart is actually misleading. If we were looking at a continuation chart here, it would show you a $124 top. So it can be very misleading to read the charts if you don't know whether you're looking at a contract chart or a continuation chart. Why have we seen this? Well, as I've been saying for several months, I expected the market to continue to grind higher because of the unprecedented tightness of this market. But then I said, at some point, we've got to price in a U.S. recession, which back when I first said that was a very non-consensus view. As it's become a consensus view in the last couple of months, sure enough, we had that mid-June peak at $124. This big sell-off has been the market pricing in the coming recession. Is that over? Did we see that reversal candle back last week after the Libya news and that was it? Or do we still have another wave down, maybe to the contract 200-day moving average, which is not shown here on page 5, but it's down there at 87 spot 69. I think it's entirely possible that if we get more bad news about the recession, we could get a test there. But ultimately, I think we move much, much, much higher. And the reason is we haven't seen a physical market this tight in at least a decade, and I think it's going to get worse because this is being driven by a lack of investment and because the ESG trend has made the sector practically uninvestable by most institutional investors. We've got a real problem here, and it's a supply problem. And yes, there will be demand destruction in the coming recession, lots of demand destruction. That's why we've seen the market sell off so much in the last month or so. I don't think it's going to be enough to overcome the supply issues. I'm working on getting another guest who's done some really excellent writing in this, a guy named Adam Rosenzweig, onto the show in order to talk about this. But until we can get that interview lined up, I'm not sure where it is that the recession gets priced in and we start going up. But I think eventually in coming months and years, we're going much higher in oil prices. It will eventually cripple the economy and lead, I think, to an inflationary deep recession or maybe even an inflationary depression. I think it could get really ugly.
So, Eric, you were talking about the fact that you got that European gas situation wrong last week and a few listeners called you out on it. Where were you wrong on the call?
Well, Patrick, I didn't actually say I was wrong, but you're right. I was wrong. What I said last week, and I do stand by my conviction on this part, is I said, look, if Vladimir Putin wanted to squeeze Europe and really make them suffer because of the sanctions that have been levied against his country, he's not going to cut off the gas in July when they don't need it that much. He's going to wait till October when they really need it for heating season. Now, I stand by the seasonality call that that's when Vladimir Putin is going to want to put the squeeze on Europe. What I didn't understand until several of our listeners wrote in, most politely, a couple not so politely, explaining that the way the mechanics of the European gas market work is Europe spends the summer importing Russian gas and storing it in underground storage tanks. And then they spend the entire winter heating season both importing more through the Nord Stream pipeline, but also drawing down from that storage. So the point is, if you want to squeeze Europe in October, the way you do it is you shut off the gas before October, because otherwise it gives Europe time to fill up their tank, so to speak, and get ready to weather the storm. So I did miss that. I didn't understand that nuance of the mechanics of European natural gas. Remember, I'm an oil trader, not a net gas trader. So I appreciate the many listeners who wrote in to explain that. I still stick by my story, though, which is if Putin wants to put the squeeze on Europe, he's going to do it in a way that is timed to make it most painful just as we get into heating season. And cutting the gas off earlier, it sounds like, is the way to do that. So therefore, it should come as no surprise that Gazprom this week first declared force majeure, said that they were shutting off the gas. It sounded like, from the way the notice was written, like they were shutting off the gas and not turning it back on, and Europe was going to be completely cut off from Nord Stream pipeline gas out of Russia. They later clarified that it would be restarted this week, but at reduced flow due to mechanical limitations, which they say, Russia says, are a result of Western sanctions. It was restarted today, one day ahead of the original schedule, but at reduced flow. My take, this was an intentional warning shot across Europe's bow. This was Vladimir Putin showing his teeth, making it look like he had cut Europe off completely. That was the doomsday scenario that everybody was concerned could completely crash the European economy. Then after letting them stew on that for a day or two, he said, oh, actually, we'll go ahead and turn it back on, but at reduced capacity. Is the reduced capacity maybe intended to just hold them over because he doesn't want to show all of his cards yet, but to prevent them from building up too much gas in storage, you know, give them enough gas to use, but not give them enough gas to build up their storage tanks? It makes sense to me. Let's see what the future brings.
Now, Eric, you said that there was an important announcement from Saudi Arabia after the presidential visit. What was that all about?
Well, for context, Saudi Arabia is currently pumping about 10.5 million barrels per day of production. That's already set to increase to 11 million barrels per day when they finally remove all of the curbs that they had put on in reaction to the COVID pandemic. Now, with the removal of those COVID restrictions, they're going to be back to 11 million barrels per day. President Biden tried to get them to increase production or agree to increase production. They said no. But what they did say they would do is that they would, and I think they probably did this because they wanted to give Biden some kind of, you know, something he could announce as if he had made some sort of progress, even though he really made no progress at all. What they said is, well, look, our capacity, the most we could possibly produce if we wanted to, is 12 million barrels. Now, personally, Patrick, I'm skeptical of that $12 million figure, but that's their advertised maximum production capacity. What they announced after President Biden's visit is that they would make their best efforts to increase that maximum capacity to 13 million barrels by 2027. So over a five-year period, they would increase their maximum production from 12 million to 13 million, but they're not going to do anything more than 12 million now. They're going to wait and use the mechanism of the OPEC Plus structure in order to decide when they would make any increases. So they said no way to an increase that President Biden wanted in terms of doing anything immediately, but they did say they would do their best to increase capacity. They went on to emphasize, and this is the most important point, that 13 million would be the ultimate capacity for Saudi Arabia and that they would never, ever be able to go higher. They later qualified their statement to say to get to 13 million barrels of production capacity by 2027 is going to be really challenging, and they're not even certain that they can promise that. Now, in context, the absolute most that Saudi Arabia could produce now if they wanted to. In other words, if they felt differently about President Biden and they said, we're going to do anything we possibly can to make this guy happy, the most they could do is increase from the 11 million that they're already planning to increase to next month up to 12 million. Well, that's an additional 1 million barrels. That would do nothing more than to make up for the million barrels a day that's currently being drawn from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which is completely unsustainable. That's got to stop at some point. They've announced it's supposed to stop this fall. So if it really does stop this fall, if Saudi Arabia did the absolute most that they possibly could, stretched their capacity to the absolute limit, it would be a net nothing in the sense that all it does is make up for the SPR not being drawn down recklessly any more than it already has been, and when they stop at some point. Now, I don't believe that they could even produce 12 million barrels. I think that at 11 million, they're going to be producing as fast as they possibly can, and I think they're already stretched on their spare capacity, but that's just my personal opinion. Now, what I want you to think about is what if, as part of this ongoing war with the West, what if Vladimir Putin were ever to intentionally pull the gas first and then the oil off the market? In other words, he shuts down the Nord Stream pipeline, says, Europe, no more gas for you. We're sick of your sanctions. We don't want to play your game anymore. And then he says, you know what? We've decided that we're going to reserve the oil we produce for export to other BRICS countries within our BRICS bloc to strengthen the value of being in the BRICS bloc. We're not going to export to anybody in the West because we're sick of the way that you've treated us with these sanctions. Or even consider this. What if Putin only took half of his exports off the market? Would that cause his revenue to go up or to go down? Of course, if he reduces exports by half, you'd think that the revenue would be cut in half. But wait a minute. If it causes the price to double, which I think it would, he ends up with the same money, and then he can continue producing the rest of the oil and stockpile it in his own strategic petroleum reserve, because I think we're headed into a global energy crisis that will last at least a decade. And I think that this war with Russia will ultimately be a resource war that is entirely about Russia withholding access to crude oil and natural gas as a tool of economic warfare. Now, if he was really intending to do that, I know this sounds like wild-eyed speculation on my part. A lot of people have said on Twitter that I'm crazy and fear-mongering and all this stuff. If he really wanted to do those things, he would be trying to make strategic alliances with other oil producers and get everybody kind of together on his team. You know, think of it as Russia and BRICS trying to acquire OPEC Plus or merge into OPEC Plus and make them all part of his family and under his control. Next headline, Gazprom announced this week a major partnership with Iran to invest as much as $40 billion with a B dollars in building new oil wells to help Iran to restore its full production capacity. So at a time when Russia is supposedly being squeezed for cash, tight on money, they're going to spend $40 billion helping Iran to build a strategic partnership. Why? I think because Putin is playing the long chess game here. He understands that having control over as much of the global energy supply as possible is the clear way to be in the opposite position of what took out the Soviet Union in the 80s. A lot of people think that the way that the Cold War was ultimately resolved was Ronald Reagan doing everything he could to get oil prices down so that Russia would be crippled economically. I think that Putin is playing a long chess game here, which is entirely about trying to be in control of as much of the world's energy supplies as it can so that he can be in the superior position. And it is the West that can be economically crippled because he's holding all of the cards. Certainly, this new announcement about Iran fits perfectly into that. If I'm right, the thing to watch for would be Russia getting friendly with other producers. Venezuela's political situation is more complex than Iran. They're not as obvious or as easy of a country to make an ally of Russia's. But boy, they've got the reserves. They've got a huge, huge proven set of reserves that they don't have the infrastructure to actually produce. They need foreign investment to do it. For Russia to cozy up to Venezuela, just as they are now cozying up to Iran and try to essentially create a monopoly on many of the biggest producing countries in the world, would be exactly the way that I think Putin is trying to turn the BRICS into the major economic superpower that has control over the rest of the world. And frankly, I think he's playing a very astute chess game. While Western leaders, including President Biden, seem to think they're playing checkers and scratching their heads trying to figure out what the funny shaped pieces on the board mean. At least that's the way that this appears to me. Now, I don't know if Putin intends to hold the world hostage with energy prices and take over the world, or if he just wants to have a big stick so that he can walk gently with it and show the West that he's got a lot more power than they used to give him credit for. But it seems to me that he has an agenda here. It seems to me that it is a long-term agenda and that it involves controlling energy-producing resources around the globe, not just in Russia.
Well, Eric, after that long monologue, is there anything else left to say about oil?
I'm shocked that you're actually asking me that. I didn't think you would give me the chance. Now, I'm done for this week, but you know, right. This is a rapidly evolving market. Let's move on, though, to your RBOB gasoline chart. What do you think of the technical picture here on page 7?
Well, it's actually a very similar situation. We have a 50% retracement coming back down to the lows of March and April, and it'll be a really interesting level where if it was going to put in short-term lows, this is sort of a level where things can emerge. I don't know if I want to anchor that today's candle is somehow important, but I think that the selling has gotten quite intense here, and I feel that it's much closer than not to a bottom. But I wanted to go and just look at the next two charts very quickly.
Well, before you do that, Patrick, I will add one more comment on crude oil. I just can't resist because the last monologue took so long that even though I said earlier we're speaking to you before the close today, so much time went by. It's time for the close. And we got slammed down in the last few minutes of trading, just struggling to see. There's about 2 minutes left as I'm speaking, and we're struggling to see if we're going to hold the 8-day moving average, which is the lowest of the three short-term moving averages. Looks to me like we're not getting a reversal candle today, and there's probably still lower to go in this market. We'll see what happens. Anyway, let's move on.
All right. Well, I wanted to just quickly point out that so far, the copper chart on page 8 has been a very weak rally, very similar to gold in a sense that there's simply just not a pulse yet here to be found. It's very oversold. Under all normal circumstances, it should have delivered some sort of reactionary bounce that should have got us back to 350, 375, and there just is nothing yet. It'll be interesting. It's still very oversold, still can have a short-term rally, but I still think that the primary downtrend has to be respected. Just there's no sign of any buying whatsoever. And the last thing I wanted to touch on with lumber prices, just after lumber in June retested all of the 2021 lows after being more than down 50% in just second quarter of the year. And but here we are once again coming back to retest that level. I'm curious whether or not this is where the bottoms in lumber will establish themselves as we test these lows again, or whether or not there's more to come. And that's certainly something that's going to be on my mind.
Patrick, I agree. This is a very important chart to watch because it's so tightly coupled to the home building market. And, you know, it seems like the post-COVID, let's move out of the city if we're wealthy and go build a big fancy house in the countryside someplace. I think that's pretty much played out. Now we've got a really big recession coming, or at least I think a really big recession is coming. You would think that would mean lower lumber prices, but hold on. I think it's going to be an inflationary recession, or a stagflationary recession. Does that mean lumber prices and home building costs go up or go down? Hard to say. I guess time will tell. Listeners, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, be sure to check out pages 10 and 11 where you can find out about a free trial of Big Picture Trading, Patrick's trading service, because he does webinars every single day of the week. So you can see a chart deck like this every single day with a free trial. Get that information on page 10 and 11 or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the slide deck that Harley provided, as well as the chart book we just discussed here in the post game, as well as a link to a number of articles that we found really interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow me on Twitter at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.